This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now, Howie Hawkins, the recent Green Party candidate for governor, joins Building Bridges to respond to Governor Cuomo's proposed budget and State of the State address. He'll also discuss the recent arrest of Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver and the culture of corruption that dominates the state capitol.
But first, let's listen to U.S. Attorney Parit Bharara one day after charging one of New York's leading lawmakers with exploiting his office to obtain millions of dollars in kickbacks and bribes. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York delivered a stinging condemnation of the culture of corruption in Albany and said the system was set up to breed misdeeds.
The prosecutor, Parit Bharara, speaking at the New York Law School, castigated how deal-making has long been done in Albany by three men in a room, the governor, the state assembly speaker, and the state senate majority leader, who work in secret and without accountability to decide most vital issues. Let's listen.
What part of the problem may be, at least in New York and Albany specifically, it's the concentration of power. Power in New York State, as far as anyone can tell, is unduly concentrated in the hands of just a few men. Some say just three men. There are, by my count, 213 men and women in the state legislature, and yet it is common knowledge that only three men essentially wield all the power: the governor, the assembly speaker, and the Senate president. So I must confess a little bit of confusion about this. When did this come to pass? Why has everyone just come to accept it? So I have a little bit of a hard time getting my head around this concept of three men in a room. Maybe it's just me. I'm an immigrant from India, which is overpopulated. So for me, it's like a billion men in a room. So it could be that I'm just a little bit dense about it, but I would think that it wouldn't just be me, that lots of people would have questions about three men in a room. Like, why three men? Can there be a woman? Do they always have to be white? How small is the room that they can only fit three men? Is it three men in a closet? Are there cigars? Can they have Cuban cigars now? After a while, doesn't it get a little gamey in that room? The concept of three men in a room seems to have disappointingly taken root as opposed to being questioned. It's almost become like part of the political furniture. It's weird to me that officials and writers joke about it good-naturedly, as if they're talking nostalgically about an old sitcom coming up after Happy Days. It's three men in a room. Or like it's a hijinks comic movie involving a baby with Ted Danson and Tom Selleck and Steve Guttenberg changing diapers. Or maybe, I don't know, the Three Amigos. So three men in a room, is that really how government should be run? Is that really the way to run a state of almost 20 million people? When did 20 million New Yorkers agree to be ruled like a triumvirate in Roman times? You know, important decisions in my own office are made with more than just three people in a room. In fact, the decision to federally charge the Speaker of the Assembly was made by more than three people in a room. You know, on a serious note, the concept of three men in a room has consequences. Common sense will tell you that. If you know you won't have power unless you are one of the lucky three, why would you bother to run and join the legislature in the first place? Good people don't waste their time that way. If you want to make a difference or you want to make a change, you might not bother if you know you can't be one of the three. If you're one of the three men in a room and you have all the power, and you always have, and everyone knows it, you don't tolerate dissent because you don't have to. You don't allow debate because you don't have to. You don't favor change or foster reform because you don't have to, and because the status quo always benefits you. And on the other side of the coin, if you're one of the three men in the room, you keep people in the dark because you can. You punish independent thinking because you can. You demand lockstep loyalty because you can. You get swept up in the power and the trapping because you were never challenged and because you can easily forget who put you there in the first place. And so I ask again, what kind of a system is that that everyone seems to accept and good-naturedly joke about? Is that really the best way? And I venture to guess that not a single person in this room, or perhaps anyone else, save for three, disagrees with me.
And now Harry Hawkins, recent Green Party candidate for governor.
I'm trying to organize a screen party. I met with people in Brooklyn and Bronx this morning, and I was down in Albany three times this week meeting with Greens and also trying to speak out on respond to Cuomo's austerity budget and state of the state address and the policies he put forward. Well, and then Silver got arrested on Thursday in the middle of all that, so it's been quite busy.
Indeed. Well, Preet Bharara has a wonderful sense of humor there as he spoke before the students. And I wanted to have you chime in on this. I mean, I was thinking that the real estate mogul apparently at the center of the Silver case, Leonard Litwin, had given over $1 million to Cuomo's campaign fund. You've described Albany as a cesspool of greed that is dominant. Put it together for us, the whole issue of the knowledge or what should have been the knowledge of Cuomo.
Well, the thing that Preet Bharara said in the recording you just had, which I hadn't heard before, that really struck me was, why would anybody want to be in the assembly if three men in a closet have all the power? And I think the answer to that is it's a criminal enterprise. You don't go there to be a legislator. You go there to be able to hand out favors, get outside salaries, and enrich yourself. That's why since 2003, 42 people down there, including a couple governors, have got into trouble. Out of Preet Bharara said 213. That's one out of five people. You go into the highest crime neighborhood and you won't find that many people having, you know, got in trouble with the law. So that's the problem down there. You know, Governor Cuomo, if he hasn't done anything illegal, what he has done ought to be illegal in the sense that he raised $47 million, over $20 million of it from just 333 people who gave him over $40,000 each. They are the people that have bought our state government. And it's pay to play. I think you could call it a criminal enterprise. What they're doing ought to be criminal. So we need some basic reforms, starting with campaign finance reform. I think the legislature ought to be full-time and not be allowed to take outside income if we're going to elect them and pay them a good salary to work full-time for us. We need independent ethics oversight, not ethics committees that are appointed by the people they're watching. You know, one way to open up this process and get it out of that three men in a closet is to have proportional representation, multi-parties down there. What proportional representation elections do is make every vote count. So, you know, the Green Party is not a majority party, but people know that every vote they give to us gets us more representation in the legislative body. And that gives everybody motivation to come out. We just had an election where we had the lowest turnout since 1942, and so there's a whole lot that ought to be done.
Well, Cuomo, to return to the reason why we originally asked you on the show, has finally heard the speculations about income inequality and talks about poverty, but is he really addressing it?
No. He did some baby steps in the right direction, like on the minimum wage. We'll go from $9 to $10.50. So that's amelioration, not ending poverty, because those are still poverty wages. It's $11.50 in the city, $10.50 in the rest of the state is what he's proposed. The state has cut over $1 billion from human services since 2009 after the Great Recession. And this budget, it's another austerity budget, will cut over $300 million from human services. Now, he's touting a circuit breaker property tax and rent rebate for low-income and moderate-income people, but what he's giving with that, he's taken away with the other hand in the form of these cuts. To get the surplus he needs to pay for that tax break, he has to do over $7 billion cuts to the state budget between now and 2018. So it's austerity, and it's the working people that are paying for it.
You would think at this time, with the national upheaval on the part of particularly young people over criminal justice issues and issues of policing, that there would have been a greater sensitivity and perhaps a real reform agenda. I heard nothing on a criminal justice reform agenda that was providing any meaningful steps towards ensuring police accountability. I wonder if you could address that, Howie Hawkins.
He did make some minor reforms, some of which are good, raising the age of adult responsibility on criminal cases from 16 to 18 is a step in the right direction. He called for a reconciliation commission. We called for a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. He said it was about improving community police relations. We were thinking of something much broader, where we would examine the damage done to particularly poor communities of color by the war on drugs and stop and frisk and broken windows that have incarcerated, led to mass incarceration and destroyed individuals, their families, their communities. And after investigating and getting the evidence, seeing how we can repair the damages. So we'll have to see what that Reconciliation Commission is all about. But what he didn't do was get at the root causes of mass incarceration and the confrontations between people in the community and the police, which has led to these killings. And that is the war on drugs and over-policing of poor communities of color under the name of stop and frisk and now broken windows. That's what needs to be addressed if we're going to really have criminal justice reform.
One could also say that even smaller issues such as a permanent independent prosecutor, which has been called for, or enacting an executive order to assign power and responsibility to investigate and prosecute all cases of police killings assigned to the New York State Attorney General. You'd think that there might have been some movement in that direction.
Well, in that area, he seemed to snub Attorney General Schneiderman, who asked for that power, and say, I'll appoint a monitor who, if they think there's enough evidence, will appoint an independent prosecutor, which seems a much weaker response. You do need independent prosecution of these cases because the DAs work with the police every day, and they're caught in a conflict of interest, even if they have the best of motives, because they've got to stay on the good side of the police to be able to do their prosecutions. And that's why we need independent prosecution in these cases.
Well, the one reform that he came out very, very hard on, and I like the way he uses the term reform, is school reform. And on that, he really lays it all on the teachers and their union. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, that's the part that really got my blood boiling. There was one graphic he had in his PowerPoint which said, look, the underperforming schools are getting more money. What he had up there was the state aid to schools, not the total amount of money they're getting from the local contribution added on to that. If he had put that up, he'd have shown that the bar graph was sloping the other way and that the poorest communities, we have numbers out from the Alliance for Quality Education, that the 20% poorest districts, the students are getting $9,000 less per student than in the 20% richest districts. He said money doesn't matter. Well, it does. If he'd put the real figures up there, his argument would have been blown up. And that's why I thought he was deliberately misleading on that and using that as an excuse to say money doesn't matter, therefore we're going to harden the teacher evaluations. He had a bill, because there was so much uproar over them, to put a moratorium on them for 2 years, and then he didn't sign it. Instead, he wants to raise the percentage of the evaluation of teachers to 50% on standardized test scores. And the academic research says the teacher makes a difference of between 1% and 14%. The overwhelming majority of the variability in test scores of students is attributed to socioeconomic status, what class you're coming from. That research has been reconfirmed for half a century over and over and over. He should look at the science on education because his whole approach is wrong-headed. I mean, you need the teachers to help teach the kids, and instead he's attacking them and really opening the door to privatization. And then you look where the money coming from for these campaigns like we were talking about before. And we have another paper out recently showing that the interests and the individuals that are wealthy and hedge fund people, basically, who can make money off investing in charters, have put over $10 million into the last campaign. People say, well, all the charters are nonprofit. Yeah, but they hire a for-profit management company. And then there's the whole real estate game they play building the charter schools, where they can get federal tax breaks as well as interest and principal back on the construction. They can double their money in 7 years under that. They're in there for the wrong motives. It's about money, not about improving the education for our children. So I think he declared war on public schools and the teachers. He wants to take away the democratic control of our schools by instituting mayoral control, not only in New York City, where they took away the elected school board, but now in upstate cities, like my city of Syracuse. Buffalo is certainly a target, Rochester, and so forth.
And just to be clear, what he wants to do is to hold up the money to the poor school districts, which was actually mended by a court settlement, unless basically the legislature goes along with his attacks against teachers and their union.
And even if they did everything he said, it's half what the Board of Regents has asked for, half what the public schools have asked for, half what the teachers union has asked for. You talk about $1.1 billion. They're talking about between $1.9 and $2.2 billion just to get back to the foundation aid, which was formulated to respond to those campaign for fiscal equity cases, which won in court, that said we have inequitable funding, particularly for the urban schools, that it needs to be rectified. And we did decide to rectify in 2007, and since the Great Recession, we've balanced the state budget on the backs of school children. And then he says, you know, he's all for the kids, but by him saying, do what I say, and then we'll give you the money, he's basically doing what's good for him, not what's good for the kids.
So what we're still seeing is an advocacy for standardized test scores that, again, you mentioned earlier, look like a pay-to-play politics. And in terms of also the issue of privatization of our schools, we have to remember that there's this enormous group of hedge fund managers who have played a critical role in that and who invested more than $10 million in last year's election and stand to profit from charter school investments. Is that not true?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And standardized tests are the rationalization, so they justify the closing of schools in poor communities, and then they can be converted to charters. Lainey Guinier had a good phrase I saw last week where she said, you know, we have a testocracy, standardized tests, masquerading as a meritocracy. And the problem is, as I was talking about before, these standardized tests really don't measure what the teachers are doing in the classroom. And the teachers, from good to bad, only account for a very small proportion of the variability on those test scores. So they're measuring the wrong thing. You know, we have the most segregated schools in the country. We have the seventh worst distribution of state school aid to our schools. Those are the things we need to address. And because socioeconomic status is the biggest thing that affects how kids do in school, we've got to attack what goes on outside the school. We need a real anti-poverty program. We need jobs. We need to address the crisis of housing. Half the renters in this state pay more than 30% of their income for housing, and one-third of the homeowners do because of our high property taxes. And the reason we have high property taxes is we stop taxing the rich, we impose mandates on local communities, and the only way they can pay for those mandates from the state is to raise their property taxes. And now Cuomo's put them in a bind because he's put a cap on how much he can raise the property taxes. He's frozen revenue sharing with the municipalities at a low level. And so the only thing they can do is cut services to stay within that 2% cap. So it's really an austerity budget that imposes a lot of hardship on local governments and doesn't give them the leeway they need to solve their own problems.
You know, there are at least 300,000 New York homeowners who are at risk of losing their homes. And you'd think the governor's speech might relate to that and might relate to the inner circle of billionaires, which includes Blackstone executive Bill Morrow, who is very much part of their inner circle and deal with these hedge funds and deal with this blow to working families, low-wage workers, teachers, homeowners, and public school students. I was just really amazed that there was nothing there to deal with these private equity firms like Blackstone that are seeking to buy more foreclosed homes, which they can profit from.
Yeah, I was really struck. I listened to the whole speech in the PowerPoint live on live stream on the computer, and he never said a word about housing, not about the rent control that has to be renewed in New York and some other cities in the state, not about dealing with the people facing foreclosure. He could have done what the Green Mayor of Richmond is trying to do, and that is if the banks won't refinance them at the current property values for those people that could stay in their homes if they were refinanced, they're going to take those mortgages over by eminent domain and refinance them, and that's the program that we need to do statewide. It would help those homeowners, but there was nothing in the speech. There's nothing in the policy proposals he has this year.
Yeah, and I just want to emphasize that there are millions of rent-stabilized, rent-controlled housing, and the issue of the rent laws is set to sunset, and the issue for New York City, which is very important, of control of its own determination on that. Yeah, absolutely not a blithering word.
It needs to be strengthened.
That brings us back to corruption because
of course,
the real estate interests in New York City by the politicians upstate, who who determine the rent control laws down in the city.
Precisely.
And that's because of the Erstad law that basically had the state take over control. And that law needs to be repealed. You know, one of the striking things to me is, you know, the Democratic Party has people that call themselves progressives, but I see no movement, I mean a real movement in advocacy for repealing their Erstad law or for restoring progressive taxation so we can get our fiscal house in order and fund the programs that people need. I mean, other states, you know, Governor Brown in California got a referendum to raise taxes on the rich and to really improve their fiscal situation. Minnesota, Maryland, I don't know what the Democrats, I mean, I'm a Green and I want the Greens to get elected, but at least they think there were some progressive Democrats would be speaking out. And it's just the absent. And that goes back to the three men in a room and the rest of them are afraid to speak out. And maybe that's because they're in the legislature for the wrong reasons, a lot of them. You know, not to do legislation for the people, but to use their position to get wealthy.
And I want to come back to minimum wage because you mentioned it before, but it's really just in passing. And his proposal to increase it to $10.50 for the state and $11.50 for the city, New York City, is really criminal. And nobody's really calling him on that at all. And also, his state labor department does not enforce the labor law.
Yeah, the labor laws, whether it's a ripoff of people's overtime or the fact, and there's millions of dollars that are being ripped off of low-wage workers who have filed claims with the Department of Labor that Cuomo has ignored. As a matter of fact, there's litigation commencing on that.
I believe it's $1 billion in New York City alone.
Yes, that's
wage theft. That is the bosses stealing money from their workers. The backlog of cases, and not everybody complains to the Department of Labor, is 2 years. So this is, you know, more of this criminal enterprise that is our government. You know, they do the bidding of their campaign backers that tend to be the business interests. Yeah, that's a whole other area. We're calling for $15 an hour with the right of local communities to set a higher standard. $15 an hour is less than the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom asked for. They asked for $2, which they figured, you know, A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and Martin Luther King figured would be enough to pay for your basic bills back in 1963. You adjust that for inflation, it's $15.50 today. So $15 is certainly reasonable and necessary if we really want to help people that are struggling.
And
Governor Cuomo could do this. He doesn't have to go to the legislature. He could form a wage board and say, we need a minimum wage that's a living wage. He has that authority under New York. And
can you say that one more time?
He could form a wage board that could, and instruct it to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, and they would find it would have to be at least $15 an hour. He has that authority.
I see your assent, Ken. One of the things that we haven't mentioned, we are talking to the former candidate for the governor from the Green Party, and we haven't once said the word sustainable energy or talked about what, Mr. Cuomo? What happened to his 100% green energy by 2030? And what would that mean to have a real energy component to the state of the state agenda? And what would it mean for jobs, among other things? Howard Hawkins?
Well, we have studies that show if we committed to 100% green energy by 2030, that would create 4.5 million jobs building the system out and would cut energy costs in half by the 2020s. That is an economic revival program as well as a program to deal with the climate crisis that we're facing. And I kind of thought Cuomo might try to up the ante on Governor Brown in California, who just set some goals of 50% green energy by 2030. Instead, he said he's throwing this much money at renewables, you know, $20 million for the Southern Tier, $20 million for five other state cities to compete for, little money for the Green Bank, you know, to back up the loans on Wall Street for some green energy. They're doing a reforming the energy vision, which is trying to smarten up the grid so it'll accept distributed energy, but it looks problematic because the utilities remain in place and they prefer centralized power. So there's a lot of moving parts, but instead of what we want is a goal, and then you back plan from that, and then you know how much investment to put in things. So he makes these little gestures, but the reality is, if you look at his draft energy plan, and that's supposed to come out in a few weeks as a final version, it's a plan for natural gas for heating, cooling, and electric power, and oil for transportation. It's a fossil fuel plan, and actually it envisions more nuclear than we have now, which is crazy because there are no nukes on the drawing board, and the nukes we got are scheduled to be decommissioned by then, by 2030. So that plan means that we've got to, now that we've stopped fracking, we've got to stop the fossil fuel infrastructure. The export of liquid nitrified gas off Long Island, the gas storage by Seneca Lake and the Finger Lakes, the many pipelines and compressor stations that are being built, the import of frack waste for desalting roads and dust suppression on dirt roads. That waste is toxic and radioactive. About a dozen counties have said you can't bring it into our county, including Rob Astorino, the Republican candidate's county, but Governor Cuomo's DEC has permitted it. So we got a two-pronged fight, to fight the fossil fuel infrastructure and then push for setting that goal. Governor Patterson set a goal of 80% reduction of carbon by 2050, and that needs to be updated to 100% reduction by 2030. We've got to stop the fossil fuel infrastructure, because if we build that infrastructure, then there won't be money to invest. We already have an energy system set up for the decades to come. So we've got to stop the new infrastructure for fossil fuels and start building the infrastructure for green energy.
And we're going to let Howie Hawkins continue to do the organizing that the Green Party has.
The very good organizing.
The very good organizing, and what a crisp, important critique of Governor Cuomo's state of the state, and with, most critically, the issue of alternatives and what an agenda is that we can follow to move towards a progressive state of affairs. We look forward to another candidacy for you, and who knows, maybe congressional or what have you at this point. But Howard Hawkins,
go for it.
Thanks for the good work. And again, we've been speaking with Howard Hawkins, recent Green Party candidate for governor.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and look forward to more discussion.
We'll have many. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.